set purpose and where that's going to be used at the various state levels. The rest was in settlements with various states for the damage incurred. So as we go forward, there's going to be a lot of concern about whether that money actually goes to restoration. $18 billion could go a long way towards restoring some of the systems that were damaged, some of the ecological damage. Obviously, you can't put a complete price on a healthy ecosystem, but the first and foremost thing on our mind is, does that money actually go to some form of positive reconstruction, or is it just going to go to restoring conference centers on the Gulf of Mexico that weren't even there when the disaster happened? That's one case in Alabama where the local municipality wants to use some of the funds for rebuilding a convention center. Now, it was one that had been damaged. It had previously existed. It had been damaged in a hurricane before the BP spill, and now this looks like a convenient way to get the money to rebuild that. But it could, as far as the ecological restoration goes, that money really needs to go into such things as shoring up the delta. The Louisiana-Mississippi River Delta is rapidly shrinking. There was a lawsuit brought in the last year or so against, I think, 70 oil and gas companies for the erosion damage done to the Gulf from all the canals to service oil wells and infrastructure across the Delta. Now, the Delta is shrinking for some natural reasons as well. When you dam up and control a river, you prevent it from spreading and depositing the mud all over the Delta, the intersection with the river. That does cause the land eventually to subside and sink, but the erosion has gone much faster because you have all of this low-lying swampland crisscrossed by ponds or by canals and by access areas for boats to get in and service oil and gas wells. Do we accept that as a cost of business? I mean, we're talking to you today through a very complicated set of technological equipment. We would not be able to do that without some of the modern technologies we have, but we need to factor in those costs for restoration. And one thing that SkyTruth could be doing, we're hoping that maybe as things clear up where that was $18 billion in restoration money is going, one thing we could do is make sure that restoration is actually taking place. We don't need high-resolution spy satellite quality imagery to tell if an effort to fill in an area that has eroded to shore up land along the river is actually being effective, or marsh restoration is taking place. We can use publicly available satellite imagery from the Landsat program to look at, you know, whether land starts appearing at a place where they're trying to do a sediment diversion. And one thing I've heard discussed for Louisiana is that they might use some of those restoration funds, at least as a down payment on some massive engineering projects to, as I said, shore up the Delta, to divert sediment into areas, let that fill back in. It's control of nature. That was one book that I studied by John McPhee. It's a great piece on the various ways that humans try to control the environment. It's perhaps not as efficient as the letting the natural process just flood and distribute mud and sediment wherever nature so dictates. But when we have humans living in close proximity to changing landscapes, you know, we have to try to control that to prevent damage to human property, risk to human life. But those things are not cheap. Diverting, you know, millions of tons of sediment to an area that we want it to go when it's flooding, that's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap.
Now, with that diversion of sediment to these areas, is that principally for environmental purposes? Does it have more to do with anticipation of flooding or hurricane prevention, or is this strictly an ecological move?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. If you look at the way that the Mississippi River Delta has shrunk, and I believe we have a time lapse of that on our blog, blog.skytruth.org, you can see over the last couple decades, just where we have a good, consistent satellite image record of how the delta has changed, you see it's shrinking, and you have to look at the models predicting climate change, sea level rise, storm surge risk is going to increase. So you want that buffer. Even if you're not filling in land to put houses back in, you want that marsh there to prevent the massive storm surge like you saw that did such damage during Katrina. So it's a combination, I think, of ecological. We do want the marsh to be restored, but also making sure that there's enough natural systems out there that are designed to absorb the energy. It's kind of an interesting comparison. That kind of natural buffer is the mangroves around the Indian Ocean. I don't know if you like farm or if you like shrimp, but a lot of shrimp on the market, unless you're specifically buying Gulf shrimp, that comes largely from farms across Southeast Asia, and large amounts of mangrove forest have been cleared to put in ponds where they farm large quantities of shrimp. When the 2005 tsunami hit, a lot of damage was done in areas that had cleared the mangrove forest. It's like taking the bumper off your car. We had cleared so much land that the water was able to just rush right in and impact the communities, the people who popped up around these places of work and employment, and cause significantly more damage than in areas where they had intact mangrove forests. It's all around the world you see human impacts where we take out certain parts of the natural system, and eventually it comes back to bite us.
It reminds me of something one of my high school teachers told me, a priest from Ireland. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these things that you're talking about are very, bring back a lot of memories to me, not only from my childhood and the time that I've spent on the Gulf of Mexico, but also I did work for the National Marine Fisheries, and we did contract, and I worked in a capacity of a contracting officer and did contract for environmental assessments for some of these intrusions into the Louisiana marshlands, mm-hmm. to put in additional drilling platforms and so forth. And I also later worked with the Landsat program and was contracting officer for that, and did that for a few years, both Landsat's 4 and 5 operation and then the development of Landsat 6. Now you're up to Landsat
8.
8.
Yeah.
Okay, are there any other Landsats up there, or is that the only one up there?
That was launched, I think, in, I'm going to say spring of 14. I think maybe it was spring of 13. I think it was spring of 2014. And that one will be, we expect that to be up for a while. And Landsat 7 is also still operational right now. There is some problems with it in that what they call the scan line corrector. Landsat is not basically a giant camera up there in the way that we think of it, where you push a button and the shutter snaps. It's actually a set of sensors that are sweeping back and forth, and something went wrong with one of the pieces of hardware, I believe, that corrects for the satellite is speeding by thousands of miles per hour, hundreds of miles up, so you have a complicated process of getting a clear, steady image of any one point on Earth. So the imagery has like one very narrow strip that's maybe a couple kilometers wide, if that much, and then the rest of the scene, you have some areas where you can make out towns and forest and villages, and other areas where they're just black lines because of that issue with the hardware.
Are you able to request specific pictures or specific scans or areas?
We've occasionally done that, and I actually have an image from North Dakota that was taken at night. They have a pretty consistent targeting scheme because they try to hit pretty much every place, every terrestrial point on the planet, every, I think it's 16 to 18 days. So a fairly regular schedule, but if there's anywhere that the satellite is and it's not expected to be taking images, we can ask. It's kind of a big favor to ask, but we've done that a few times. We also have access to other satellite technologies that are being tested. I believe the European Space Agency, just in the last month or so, launched Sentinel-2, which is a Landsat-like satellite. It will also be collecting multi-band, multi-spectral imagery of many places on the Earth. It's not quite as ambitious a targeting scheme as Landsat. Basically, there's no reason to repeat our efforts, but they might focus more on specific areas of interest to the European Space Agency and their collaborating partners. But that imagery is publicly available in the same way that the Landsat imagery is available. If you're listening right now and you wanted to know what a Landsat image looks like, you could go to just Google Earth Explorer. It will bring up a website. It's a little clunky to figure out exactly how to put in the place you want to look at and the date range, and then you have to select what satellite sources you want to look at. But you can get imagery just right now as you're listening to us and download a satellite image that was taken maybe yesterday. We also have some preliminary kind of beta testing partnerships with commercial satellite programs. One of those is Planet Labs. They are working on testing a new fleet of microsatellites. So instead of one big instrument that takes years of planning and development, and they build one. Maybe they build a backup. I think Landsat 6 had a backup. Landsat 6 didn't last long. I forget what happened. Something went catastrophically wrong on it for a while.
Will that work?
Yeah. But the plan with these smaller microsatellites, and this is kind of a trend in technology, really for last couple of decades, it's only now reaching the satellite, the space industry, is to have a lot more instruments that are designed to fail and you just expect to replace them. So instead of one big satellite, they plan to send up a dozen or more and then launch them either on that commercial payload's trip into orbit, or they send it up to the International Space Station and effectively chuck them out the back door at the appropriate times to put them into orbit. The idea being that you're not going to have maybe as much control over pointing any one satellite, but if you have many little satellites, yes, their orbit will decay. They'll eventually fall into the atmosphere. A few may not deploy, but you'll have many that you can replace fairly easily instead of one big one and putting all your eggs into that one basket. Same kind of technology principle with the various satellite internet programs that are presumably in the works, where many little satellites would be put into low Earth orbit, expecting to replace them as time goes on and as spaceflight gets cheaper.
These are like little drones launching from the spacecraft. This particular, and you've got your laptop open here to the page that really impressed me. Could you describe how people could maybe pull this up and look at it while we're sitting here? Because it's very impressive to see. This discloses and gives you a picture of the number of wells that are actually leaking in the Gulf of Mexico.
So slight clarification. It's the number of spills that have been reported, many of them from wells in the Gulf of Mexico since BP ended. Probably the best way to search for it is to go to, the title should probably work. It's called The Other Gulf Oil Disaster, Chronic Offshore Pollution, or simply go to blog.skytooth.org. This was published in April of 2015. The map shows an animation of all of the National Response Center pollution reports that have been received by the Coast Guard since the BP disaster was ended, when they capped it in July 2010. There are over 10,000 spill reports of oil and hazardous chemicals to the waters of the Gulf of Mexico since the spill ended. And you mentioned earlier about fools rush in where angels fear to tread. This is something that we really want people to see, is the chronic pollution. Many of these spills are not big by themselves. They may dissipate in a day or so. It may be a gallon or a barrel of oily water. It may be some drilling mud that slops over the deck of a workboat. But here's there's a couple of issues with that. One is that there are so many. If you look at the map and watch as it progresses from July 2010 to the present, and it progresses month by month, the Gulf just gets black. It just gets filled in. There's not enough space on the map to show all of these individual reports where somebody, a worker on the platform, has said, hey, whoops, we spilled something. This has a cumulative impact, and we can point the finger a lot at BP. There's certainly a disaster that took place there, and the courts ruled that it was criminally negligent the way that they behave, or not criminally negligent, gross negligence that contributed to the disaster. But they're not the source, the only source of oil, hydrocarbons, and other pollutants entering the Gulf. And what we don't know is how much this chronic insult of contaminants is affecting the Gulf ecosystem. Maybe the dolphins that are washing up, they might have come in contact with Gulf oil, but maybe they came in contact with the oil that's leaking from the Taylor Energy platform. And that is one well, actually 29 wells, that have been leaking since 2005. We only discovered this platform when we were watching the satellite imagery of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. We saw this long oil slick continually emanating from this one point about 11 miles off the coast of Louisiana, closer to shore than the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And we eventually realized that it wasn't connected to the slick that was emanating from BP. This was its own thing. And then we looked back in history and saw that it preceded the disaster before anything blew up at the Macondo prospect, and eventually dug into enough records and started asking enough questions. We found out it was an oil platform that was wiped out by Hurricane Ivan in 2005. The whole platform basically is no longer on the surface anymore. The best that we've been able to understand is that the wave action from the hurricane caused a subsea landslide, basically took out the supports for the platform and buried the wells under hundreds of feet of mud, sediment, and debris. And it has continued to trickle and leak slowly, but continually, for going on more than 11 years. And the energy company that's responsible for this has since gone bankrupt. They only really have one employee left, and their job is to make sure there's a contractor who goes out every day and flies out and looks at the site and says, yep, still leaking. I see an oil sheen that's 100 feet wide by a mile long. Now, here's also where the rub is with these spill reports and all of those other ones. We have contributed to studies that looked at where we know there's an anthropogenic spill. Somebody physically says, hey, I see a spill coming from a platform, or whoops, we goofed up. Where we know there's a source of a spill, we take what their report said, how long it was, how wide it was, how big we think that is based on those dimensions. And we compare that to radar satellite imagery. I believe this was done by students at the University of West Florida. And the conclusion was that on average, for these anthropogenic spills, they're underreporting by a factor of 10. So if they say we spilled a barrel, what our analysis shows, looking at the size, the dimensions of the spill, it's more likely to be 10 barrels. And that adds up. It adds up very quickly.
So what you're looking at on this map is reported, and you're saying that it's possibly 10 times what you're
worse.
Looking at right
yes.
there.
Now, there's a strong incentive for them not to fail to report. I mean, if an inspector flies by and sees oil coming from your platform and you haven't called it in, you could be in big trouble for not reporting that. Now, you could say, we didn't see it. But you could be in big trouble for not reporting that. There is very little incentive or disincentive regarding underreporting. So, you know, if all of you, we've used this example on John's program on Friday mornings, if you would all call into the state police right now and report how fast you were speeding. If you've been speeding in the last week, call it in and report to the state police. Now, if you had to do that, you'd probably say, if you absolutely had to do that, you'd say, oh, I was going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit. Yes, you're admitting that there was a bit of a problem, but you're not going to say exactly how fast if no one is going to follow up on it. And if the Coast Guard gets dozens of these reports a day, of somebody saying, either we spilled or we see a sheen floating through our oil field. They get dozens of reports a day. They're not likely to send out a helicopter and a crew of Coast Guard officials to investigate a reported spill of 0.00012 gallons. And we've seen reports that are so small and trivial that, like, how on earth would you possibly have measured that? Did you get an eyedropper out? Are you sitting there watching the drops and calculating how many teaspoons actually leaked? So there's a very strong probability that the number of reports probably more or less accurate, because there's an incentive not to just fail to report. But the size is probably much worse than is being reported.
It makes me think immediately of, what iPhones and smartphones and video cams have done as far as reporting or bringing to the mind of people and to their attention of police brutality.
Yeah.
And this is a case, I'm wondering what effect SkyTruth has had on reporting.
We believe that it has had a positive effect. We're not everywhere in the sense that cell phones are ubiquitous on land now. Much of this happens over the horizon, out of sight, out of mind. The people who do see it are most likely employed by either the company that may be responsible or they're working for them. There are whistleblower protections, of course, but if you get a reputation as just being a habitual troublemaker of pointing out every little drop that goes into the ocean, you might find yourself not employed very long. However, the SkyTruth element of it, looking at this from a very objective, distant viewpoint using satellite imagery, we think it has had an effect. For example, after the BP spill, there was, I think in 2012, Shell had a big spill off Nigeria, one of their floating production and storage offshore FPSO. It's a big floating oil tanker, collects oil from wells at a remote field, and then they transfer the oil from that to another tanker to take to shore. Somebody didn't notice that one of the pipes was leaking, loading up a tanker, and there was about a million or so gallons spilled off Nigeria. And they very quickly owned up to that, and they very quickly came out and said, we believe it's approximately this amount. So we had to give them credit there for being proactive and saying, yes, we spilled, this is what it looks like it is. And we're going to take some credit for that, because they know that somebody is watching. They know that somebody is going to get out a calculator and say, all right, it's this many square kilometers we see that are impacted. We assume if you can see it on a satellite image that's undoctored, it's from government sources, we assume that it's got to be a micron thick. Let's make a very conservative calculation and say this is how big it is. If they know somebody's doing that, they're much more likely to be reactive and say, hey, and own up to what took place.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 304-876-5369. And I have a question for you about what is visible versus what is not visible. And also, I'm curious about the influence of Corexit on detection and lingering effects.
Corexit is not something that we have really any ability to tell. We do know that our numbers, when we were monitoring the BP spill, we know that our numbers are very conservative because they were unable to account for how much oil was dispersed. Corexit is a oil dispersant designed to make the oil break up and or sink. And there's actually a fair amount of concern in the environmental and biological community that this was actually more toxic than the oil itself. Yes, it reduced perhaps the number of birds that were oiled by landing in the slick, but it has lasting repercussions in the ecosystem and could be as toxic to not only the wildlife, but the people then who were cleaning up afterwards. There's a number of cases, I believe, that are proceeding regarding, were people effectively aware of what the health impacts were of what they were being exposed to because many of the fishermen who were then out of work were put to work by BP to clean up or to skim or even to light the oil on fire to try to burn it off, what they call in situ burning. And those impacts will best be studied by biologists, by people getting out on the scene and doing water quality samples, tissue samples. And I do know that a number of those studies are progressing. As far as what is visible and invisible, a lot of what we're looking at is what is basically reflected sunlight, and various features in the natural world reflect sunlight in different ways. So if you have an area that was forest previously, and now all of a sudden it has been cleared due to logging, legal or illegal, the sunlight, the way that that reflects back to the sensor on the satellite, is going to come back differently, and we'll pick up that change. For example, trees reflect chlorophyll much better than bare rock and soil. So if you see a sudden change in the infrared signature that's coming back, you know that something has happened on land. Now, that may not be immediately apparent to the naked eye, but a lot of this is very coarse. We're not looking at, as I said, high-resolution spy satellite imagery. We're looking at stuff where a single pixel in the image is maybe the size of a baseball diamond. It's big stuff. And we can tell if there's a major area of land that has been cleared. We can tell if there's a big amount of oil floating out on the surface. And increasingly, we're using radar satellite imagery. I mentioned a little bit ago, Sentinel-2 was launched, which is a satellite like Landsat, which is looking at passive sunlight reflected from the Earth. Sentinel-1 is a radar satellite. And unfortunately, the United States does not have a publicly available equivalent. We had one very briefly during the 70s, I think, and it suffered a massive failure after less than 100 days in orbit, I believe. But Sentinel-1 was basically beaming down microwave energy and scanning the Earth's surface. So it's an active system, and it can be used very effectively for looking at forests, for one thing. It can actually penetrate tree cover, and I believe some people can do get some analysis, especially have a couple of images to compare. You can see roughly how much the terrain or the topography of a forest or an area has changed. Looking at the ocean, oil reflects very differently than unaffected water. So you're able to see quite clearly when there is an oil slick floating out on the water. I have an image from the Santa Barbara Channel, which has a lot of natural oil seeps, but it shows a very prominent slick that appears to be emanating from an oil platform. Radar satellite imagery is great for detecting that, and we're happy to have access to that radar satellite imagery. We're using it now to monitor Shell's operation up in the Chukchi Sea off of Alaska. I don't know if you saw in the news this week. Things were held up for about a day by Greenpeace activists who suspended themselves from a bridge in Portland trying to prevent the Fenica, which is, a Norwegian icebreaker, from returning to the Arctic. The Fenica carries a very important piece of equipment without which Shell is not allowed by Department of Interior to even try to drill for oil, but court injunctions and federal and I think state authorities moved in and did remove enough of the protesters that the Fenica is now on its way back to the north coast of Alaska. And we can use the radar satellite imagery to see where the vessels are. We posted on our Facebook page a couple days ago an analysis of that image, which shows not only what the water looks like, not only where the different vessels are. We've identified a couple of them using their location beacons that are also picked up by satellite. And we've also identified where the pack ice is, the ice that, you know, it's very warm here. You're not inclined to think of ice still being floating around, but this is the Arctic we're talking about. A little over 40 kilometers away, there's loose chunks of ice just floating around. Now, those are fairly light. They're probably not going to pose any damage. But then about 200 kilometers to the northeast, there's heavy pack ice that, if it did come in, it could possibly force drilling operations to cease. Shell has a lot of equipment in place to make sure that any big chunks of ice coming their way can be pushed away. But we're going to be keeping a very close eye on that to try and see do any oil slicks appear at the site, and how close the ice gets. Do they suddenly start clustering around one drill rig or another for some unexplained reason? We'll be keeping a close eye on what they're doing. Stuff that wouldn't easily be accessible. This is many miles from the nearest port of call in Alaska. It's not like you're going to easily set somebody out there with a camera to watch them. But we can do that with these sensors that are in orbit collecting images of the entire planet.
Do you use any form of ground truthing, drones, or anything of that nature to support what your findings?
We have occasionally done a ground truthing operation. We have one tool that, or resource we've provided that looks at flaring. That's burning off natural gas, usually from oil wells, sometimes from a gas well before it goes into production. That's a big issue in North Dakota. If you look at nighttime composite satellite imagery of North America, western North Dakota looks about as lit up as Chicago or one of the big metro areas around here.
So you could put together a map similar to this one you had for the Gulf.
Actually, we have it running. That was the first map we did.
Okay.
Yes, that shows where flares are detected. And well, what we had to do with
oil,
that.
Well, not necessarily fracking. This is oil wells for the most part.
For the most part, but you would be able to see in the Marcellus, you would be able to see if a well has recently been worked on, because they usually only flare at a gas well because they're burning off a valuable product. They only flare if they've been working on it recently and they just need to get rid of explosive gases. But the ground truthing part of that is we went out to North Dakota. We had a data set from a NOAA satellite that was originally, I think, supposed to be a spy satellite, now belongs to NOAA for some atmospheric research. But we had a raw stream of data every night that says, here's where hot points were detected at night somewhere in the world. And we wanted to say, all right, what's the temperature threshold? What in this data actually represents a flare, and what is just a small grass fire or some other operation that's not flaring? So we sent team out to North Dakota, and actually that was crowdfunded with support from a number of people in the Shepherdstown, Eastern Panhandle area, to go out. We launched a balloon with some GoPro cameras over the oil field at night. I got some interesting video. We've published a little bit of that video. I'd actually like to do some more at some point. But while we were there, we drove around to a lot of these points that we had assumed by our analysis of the imagery and the data that these are probably flares, but then we went and checked and said, yep, that's a flare, so that we knew for certain that our cutoff point was accurate. What we really want to do is, I think, to crowdsource the ground truthing. If you're not familiar with the lingo environmental science, that probably sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook. But what that means is, we want to publish information whenever there's news of a pollution report, whenever there's news maybe of new flaring in your area, or there's evidence of a major land use change. Some big chunk of forest suddenly goes from being forest to bare rock. Our goal is to provide that information as quickly as possible to citizens and then let them go out and do the ground truthing themselves. We want people to have access to the same tools and resources we have to look at the places they care about, because we're overwhelmed, trying to keep an eye on the entire planet.
So it's kind of friends of sky truth all over the globe, you might say.
But that's the goal, and it takes a while to build that up, to build up name recognition, and a lot of our work so far has been in more specialist research that we do. We'll produce a product and say, here's what we see about this image. We want a certain amount of credibility to our work to be certain that if we say we think that the BP oil spill is bigger than it really is, that information, the White House, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement and NOAA aren't necessarily going to take that seriously if just somebody in their backyard says, hey, I looked at a satellite image and I think it's bigger than what BP is saying. officials and decision makers aren't going to take that seriously. So we do need to review citizens' reports, but we really want individuals to have access to that information to be able to inform people in their community, hey, something new is going on. We provide that to some degree right now in what we call SkyTruth Alerts. You can look at that if you're next to a computer, alerts.skytruth.org. And you can sign up for any area that you're interested in North America. We have a feed of some data sources in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Colorado. We have some state data as well, so we can tell you if a new well has been permitted. We're actually scraping records from state agencies when they publish notice that a new well is going in. We'll put that point on a map and we'll let you know, hey, there's a new gas well that's been permitted in this area. Nationwide, we just have the National Response Center reports. That's the same source of data as this pollution map that we've been discussing earlier about all of the oil spills to the Gulf. But really, anyone who spills oil or hazardous chemicals is supposed to call into the Coast Guard and say, hey, X number of gallons of a contaminant have been spilled onto the ground or into the water. And we provide those reports. In some areas, they're a little heavy on fairly trivial stuff, like a cup of brake fluid from a rail line. You know, Norfolk Southern spills something on the ballast. That's a lot of the reports I see in this area, and that's really nothing to be too alarmed about because that's actually diligence in their reporting. They're doing their job. If a small incident takes place, they still report it. But in some cases, big stories can be buried in the minutia of those dozens, if not hundreds, of reports nationally that the Coast Guard receives. One case is our Secretary Terry Beeble, an office administrator. She is from New Jersey originally. She subscribed to areas that she's lived in or has friends and kept getting a notice that up to 200 pounds of hydrogen cyanide was being released into the air around a refinery in New Jersey, and I'm blanking on the name of the city right now. But just day after day after day, 200 pounds of hydrogen cyanide for almost a month. When after the first few reports came in, they're consistently coming in. She started looking into it, passed the information along to some local reporters, and they found out that some sort of equipment had malfunctioned at a refinery. And they were just taking their good old time getting around to it, and just they were submitting their reports like they were supposed to, but nobody was making a big deal to inform, hey, you know, if you're downwind of this refinery, be advised this is taking place. It took a citizen subscribed to that area to notice, hey, this doesn't look right.
But is that something you were able to detect at all?
That would not be something we would be able to detect atmospherically. There are a number of efforts for people who live near refineries to have, usually it's basic air pollution, like a particulate sensor. You have to have very sensitive equipment and very expensive equipment, like a cavity ring down spectrometer, to detect and to identify the individual gases that are in an air sample. Effectively,
so you can't detect methane. There's no way to pick that up, I suppose.
Not from satellite. I mean, there was a study actually over the Four Corners region of New Mexico, where a several month or year long study by NASA actually did detect an increase in methane over the Four Corners regions. But that is very difficult to tell, and it takes a lot of data crunching to even get to some analysis like that, mainly because there's so much noise in the atmosphere between a satellite and the sensor. A more effective way for somebody living next to a refinery or big industrial operation is going to be some sort of surrogate for air quality, and that usually is detecting particulates. Usually, if some sort of smoke or some sort of thing is being emitted from equipment, there's more than just a clean, invisible gas. There's other stuff in the air. So even though particulates may not tell you exactly what's in the air from the refinery or from the factory. If you have a small particulate sensor and it's in your living room, it will tell you if there's an increase in thing, just small particles floating in the air, and that might be an indicator that you need to check out the air quality. That is a easily accessible resource that I think our partners at Public Labs are working on. Again, as I mentioned about the increase in small satellites, easy, cheap technology. It's not very expensive. It's not high quality, but it gives you enough of an idea of what's going on. You can then take the next step. If somebody or a number of people in a community repeatedly see that their $20 particulate sensors are showing an increase in particulate matter, that might be enough to say to OSHA or to say to a university who has a $40,000 cavity ring down spectrometer, hey, can you come and do some higher quality air sampling in this area?
Does the technology exist to put into a satellite, into satellite instrumentation, something that would detect methane gas from fracking?
We really need John Amos for that question. I think, again, because of the amount of atmospheric noise, there's nothing publicly that I know of that would really do that, just looking down through all of the swirling gases in the atmosphere to specifically pinpoint a specific area and say what's going on. I've mentioned the word a couple times, the cavity ring down spectrometer. It's a very interesting instrument. It basically takes in an air sample into a small confined space, and it shines a laser beam around a bunch of mirrors. And the point is for the mirrors to bounce around enough time, or the laser pulse to bounce around enough time in this mirrored cavity to effectively have traveled, say, a kilometer through this cloud of material. And then at the end of that pulse of laser energy that's bounced around the equivalent of a mile inside this confined space, they see how much the laser beam has decayed and what certain gases absorb that energy in different ways. So they can then say, all right, this narrow band of the spectrum out of 10 different bands that we're measuring, this one band showed a really sharp decrease. That must mean that the methane absorbed a lot of that one band of energy. That kind of sensor requires a physical presence. You have to get that air sample to begin with, mm-hmm. to run that sensor through and say, all right, here's what we think happened. I think what's more likely to happen is that we'll continue to see an improvement and a decrease in price in the smaller sensors, and maybe to specifically design tools locally, that if you live right next to a facility, you can put that sensor out.
For example, someone who's getting a fracking permit, mm-hmm. to install these detectors where the information could be automatically uploaded,
yeah.
And available.
I do know that I believe it's Mike McCauley out of WVU has been working on something that I think is a middle of the road between the very inexpensive particulate sensors I was talking about and the tens of thousands of dollars spectrometer, a couple $100 package that you could put on the fence line of a well pad. I know that he did some studies around active drilling operations. They had a whole suite of air quality sensors measuring, you know, what's going on, what's drifting downstream from a fracking operation. And I believe that was for a study that was commissioned by the West Virginia legislature. Thing is, though, that was a very specialized case that required a number of graduate students and probably $250,000 worth of equipment setting on the pad. Ideally, we can figure out how to reduce the cost of that and yes, ask industry to say, all right, if you want to convince us that there's no significant sources of air contamination, of water contamination coming from your site, prove it. You know, we want you to set these equipment around the pad, just factor it in as the cost of doing business, and let us see the evidence that, you know, there's a limited amount of emissions. You're never going to, with an industrial process, have no emissions whatsoever, but you have to mitigate that as best you can. And right now, it seems the trend is more towards the cost of business is just paying fines if something really goes bad. And that's dangerous, very dangerous.
I want to ask you, going back to the Gulf of Mexico spills, I read something in conjunction with one of your websites about when the sheen is near the surface, it can be degraded by sunlight. Is this one of the main forms in which this oil is actually dispersed into the atmosphere and maybe gets out of the Gulf of Mexico? And the other question I have, and you may not be into this subject, but the big blob of oil that's down there in the mud, that's the one that, to me, is very disturbing to see. Think that it still sits there, it's unseen, and these critters, you know, that travel through these zones, they're going to be picking this stuff up one form or another, and then it's going to move through the food chain. How do you get rid of that stuff?
I do believe that sunlight, or just weathering, is one way that oil breaks down. John Amos, who founded the organization, started his career looking at satellite imagery, actually not for environmental purposes, but mainly for people who, at the time, the 90s, could afford to, the 80s and 90s, could afford to buy satellite imagery. Those were largely resource extraction companies. They were actually using satellite imagery to look for natural oil seeps. Natural oil seeps are a part of an ecosystem, and they're actually organisms that are designed, that are specially adapted to consume the oil in the natural environment. They're entire colonies of chemosynthetic bacteria that do absorb the natural amounts that enter the atmosphere or enter the ecosystem. Now, but the problem is when we inject huge amounts of oil, you know, millions of gallons of oil, or this regular drip, drip, drip of smaller spills, I believe it does overcome that natural ability to break down. I believe it's a combination of weathering and wave action at the surface. Sunlight, probably to some degree, will break down the molecules. And certain organisms in the ecosystem are able to consume that and break it down. But I don't believe we actually fully know the entirety of how that system works, how much it can handle, and we still have very brute force methods of cleaning up the oil, such as pouring dispersants on it and dumping all that down into the bottom of the ocean. I have no idea how we clean that up. I think we should. I'm quite certain that that is having a slow ripple effect back up to the food chain. You have the bottom feeders that poke around in the sediments, and then you have something that eats those bottom feeders, and then you have a top predator that collects that. And it can bioaccumulate in the system. I don't know how we clean that up, and I don't think the studies have been fully funded enough yet to actually say what the full ecological impact of the spill. I think there was a hearing in the last 6 months on the Senate, and the researchers are saying we still don't have a full understanding of everything that happened. We still don't have the resources to put together an entire explanation of where all of the oil went and how long it's going to remain in the system. And getting back to the fools rush in idea, the reason that SkyTruth focuses so much on these chronic spills in the Gulf of Mexico, any one of them by themselves is probably going to be broken down by wind and weather and biological organisms. But oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, where it's been going on since the 40s, is a big, messy business. It's not just one spill, one horrendous spill every few decades. It's a continual drip of contaminants, of activities, of releases, of accidents. It's not squeaky clean. And we need people to understand that when they're considering expanding the Atlantic seaboard. That's a big political debate right now going on. Are we going to expand offshore drilling to the coast of the Carolinas and all the way down to Florida? The Department of Interior recently approved exploration, which is seen by many as the first step in going forward. If industry is going to spend millions of dollars setting off seismic or big explosions using air bubbles to measure using seismicity where oil and gas deposits might be off the Atlantic, that's going to set the snowball in motion that they're then going to say, well, look, we spent all of this money and now we can tell you that there's 5 billion barrels of oil down under the sea. We have to go get it. That number is purely hypothetical, by the way. Mm-hmm. We're looking at rushing in there. We're rushing into the Arctic, and our cleanup methods are basically no better than they were during the Exxon Valdez. We have skimming, which is taking big booms and trying to collect the oil that's floating on the surface in one place, scoop that up. We have dispersants to spray and sink them to the bottom, so it's out of sight, out of mind. And we have in situ burning. That doesn't work 100% in the placid waters of the Gulf of Mexico. We have no idea how well that's going to work in the harsh, pristine, and ice-choked waters of the Arctic. Is that bad in the Gulf? How are we going to possibly clean it up when it gets mixed in with brash sea ice? It's going to exist in the ecosystem for decades if there's even a minor spill.
Do you have any idea about the degradation of the fishing industry, fishing tonnage, before and after the BP spill? I'm sure that was a big part of the settlement.
Yeah.
But, you know, as these things degrade over time and an industry degrades, people go out of business and they may not return. You get a new normal, a new standard of a degraded environment and a degraded industry.
There's actually kind of an odd thing in the data, and I forget who was showing me this, but there was actually a boost in the fishing productivity when people started returning to fish immediately after the worst of the spill had passed. So if you have people not out fishing because they're not allowed to for a period of time, you actually take the immediate human stressors off of the ecosystem. There was actually a small increase for a period of time in the fishing populations. The fish were able to grow up more before being caught. I do believe that there will be a decline. I think that is something that's more going to be analyzed through looking at catch numbers rather than satellite imagery, so it's not our specialty. But I believe there are studies, I believe there are people that are going to be looking at that. And we need to do those full studies. We need to be aware of that and incorporate that when we're looking at the risk of offshore drilling off the Carolinas, where you have recreational fishing, not just sending out a trawler to haul in large amounts of fish, but you know, somebody paying a healthy sum to go out on a boat and catch one big fish. If that industry completely goes away, or if people have the perception that it's toxic, that's going to kill an industry there. If you have an oil spill in the Arctic, or a toxic mine spill from the Pebble Mine, also in Alaska, into the headwaters of the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. That's one of the sources. If you like fresh Alaska salmon, that's a very well-regulated and sustainable fish stock. But if you like that, you should be concerned about the environmental impacts of putting a huge gold and copper mine in the headwaters there. Those numbers need to be studied, and they can't really be done by satellite. SkyTooth is not the be-all and end-all organization, but we do have a unique perspective on the planet to say, here's what we can see from space, here's what we can see from geospatial data. Put it on a map and hopefully get people to think about that as we consider whether or not expanding offshore oil drilling or expanding our mining operations in Alaska are a good thing.
We're running short of time, but I wanted to ask you if you would have any comments or information regarding the cruise ships. And I understand that they're a tremendous point of pollution, their discharges. Is that anything that you follow at all?
I have heard about that, and we are tracking fishing or vessel activity using satellite-based data. Cruise ships definitely fall into that. Any vessel that has passengers on it would require an AIS broadcaster, which says we know exactly where they are within maybe 5-10 minutes. They're continuing sending out a signal where they are. We have not personally been basically funded to do to research into that, to figure out where and when and how much wastes are discharged over the side. I would say that it's possible, and if we found the funding and the staff time to work on that, it's an interesting challenge, and it's one that we have encountered trying to track fishing boats, a very similar analogy. If I wanted to get a satellite image of a cruise ship possibly discharging sewage as it's approaching port, I would need to know where the vessel is, as near as I can tell from its AIS location. I would need to give that location to a satellite image company to say, please get this image for me as soon as possible. They send that command up to the satellite the next time it's over Tromsø, Norway, or somewhere over the South Pole, and then wait for the satellite to get back into position to collect the image, and then they download it, and then I get the image.
And you basically pay for that, right?
If we were doing it that way, yes, it would be, we would be paying.
You have to pay to direct the satellite to take that picture, is that right?
If we ask Digital Globe, which is one of the major satellite providers in the world right now, to collect that image for us, yes, we would pay handsomely for the luxury of that. Or we would just look in what imagery has already been collected in the archive, and we would look and see if we can see big, nasty plumes coming off the back. I would say more than satellite imagery prospect, because one image is probably not going to show you the entirety of the track of a vessel. It would be we want people to keep an eye out the back if they suddenly see something nasty churning up in the wake.
They're required to report, are they not? And I don't even know what kind of regulations there are for this industry as their discharges.
I don't know. I know that that is a concern of many conservationists, and I think it is a serious one. I would say that it's one we haven't put as much effort in as we have our global fishing monitoring work, because yes, cruise ships do potentially contribute contamination, but the wholesale mining of the oceans by commercial fishing operations, many of them illegal, 1 in 4 fish, I believe it was, at least large fish on the market, might be caught illegally. That is the main area that we focused our efforts, and we're trying to analyze not just from imagery, but also from their behavior when a vessel might be engaged in fishing. That work has recently been highlighted in the New York Times. There's a piece, a series, four-part series that I would highly recommend anyone who wants to know where their products from overseas, how they get here, to read. It's The Outlaw Ocean. It's a four-part series by Ian Urbina that starts with tracking the Donna Liberta, a vessel we identified on a radar satellite image back in 2012, a 90-mile-long oil slick from bilge dumping. This was not a cruise ship. This was a refrigerated banana hauler at the time going from Angola to somewhere in the Americas. And we saw that there was this big long oil slick. Ian Urbina started digging into the history of this vessel and found just absolutely criminal, brutal treatment of stowaways and members of the crew, and use this as a case study of the lawlessness that takes place out in the open ocean when nobody is watching. And this vessel is possibly associated with illegal fishing now as well. Even murder can take place in the high seas. That's part two of the Outlaw Ocean series. That there's a video of it that was surfaced in a cell phone video in a taxi cab in Manila, and the culprits have still not been identified. They posed with the camera afterwards, right, and we still haven't been able to identify who these individuals are or even where in the world this might have taken place. Cruise ships are a concern, but I would say that tackling the fishing and transparency of what happens on the ocean for all vessels, that's That's our big priority with the Global Fishing Watch project.
You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown. This is Seven Generations Radio, and this is Joe Gray. I'm here with David Manthos of SkyTruth. And thank you very much, David. We've kind of come to the conclusion of our hour, and it's been fascinating. You're into so much interesting stuff, it's the kind of stuff that I really enjoy hearing about. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
That is Seven Generations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Be back in 2 weeks with another show.